looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR9. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
The traditional plan is not only a traditional plan, but the biblical plan that ensures that God's word remains foundational to the life and growth of the United Methodist Church. Today, the church in Africa is growing in leaps and bounds because we are committed to biblical Christianity, the Word of God as our primary authority for faith and Christian living.
That is the Reverend Jerry Kula of Liberia speaking in St. Louis at the General Conference of the United Methodist Church, a special conference called to deal with the question of homosexuality, the LGBT agenda. There were two plans, the One Church plan and the traditional plan. He was speaking there in favor of the traditional plan. Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live this Thursday afternoon, the 28th of February. Terry Mattingly will be with us to talk about media coverage of the special session of the General Conference of the United Methodist Church and what was resolved there. A little bit later, Joy Pullman, managing editor for The Federalist, will join us to talk about universal daycare, which she says is nationalized and socialized daycare. We'll find out why then. You can join us with questions or comments. Our email right here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org. Our Twitter address, @issuesetc, and the Issues Etc. listener comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to discuss media coverage of the special session of the General Conference of the United Methodist Church, Terry Mattingly, Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate in the book Pop Goes Religion, and founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Many of the news stories that I have been reading have been reporting, in essence, that the traditionalists won in St. Louis in the United Methodist Church. Do you think this is true?
Well, they won a vote. They have been winning votes every time United Methodists get together on these issues for at least a decade, if not longer, which was why the Book of Discipline of the United Methodist Church still contains the language that the traditionalists want in terms of marriage and sexuality. Thus, you had three or four plans considered in the St. Louis meetings, three of which, the key to it was that it would do away with the language in the Book of Discipline as a mandatory set of beliefs for United Methodists. The traditional plan not only wanted the language to stay the way it is, they wanted to close a bunch of loopholes that were allowing doctrinally liberal sections of the church to get away with flaunting their disobedience to the teachings of the church. So the traditional plan won in St. Louis. But anyone who knows anything about the United Methodist Church knows what has been the case for a minimum of four decades now, which is that it functions as completely different theologically defined institutions in different parts of the country. There was a paper written that I first ran into it in the mid-1980s called The Seven Churches of Methodism, and it broke the United States down into regions and noted that these had completely different theologies, completely different standards for ordination, completely different, in some cases, gods, understanding of the Trinity, understanding of the role of Jesus Christ, understanding of the nature of the first person of the Trinity, of God the Father. So you have this radically divided church in the United States. And so you say, well, it sounds pretty liberal. Why did the conservatives the traditionalist, why did they win in St. Louis? So let me ask you a question. You know how I sometimes like to turn this around and ask you questions. Out of the stories you've been reading, how many United Methodists are there?
Well, I happen to know that there are about 13 million across the entire globe, and I think just a little bit better than half are in North America.
Well, this is interesting. The figures from the church itself are 12.5 million. That's 2 years ago, which means they probably have gone up in parts of the Third World or the Global South. They probably have gone down. But what's interesting is in the best post-St. Louis story that I have read, which is in the Washington Post, and I say best, I mean, it's better than the others. The coverage has been uniformly drenched in black mourning. It's been draped in black mourning cloths, mourning, in a nation's papers because of the loss for the doctrinal left. The United Methodist story is the better story. It still doesn't quote a single church, parish, congregation leader in the United States who's in favor of the traditional plan. It quotes one conservative leader who was behind the trad plan. That person is quoted. The same story quotes six different church leaders who opposed the plan and who are in favor of the one church compromise plan where the left could do what it wanted. And at least for now, the right could have done what it wanted and they would try to live together somehow. I called the Washington Post story the best because it even has some of the accurate information that you need. Yet at the same time, here's an interesting paragraph. Listen to this carefully. With more than 6 million members, the United Methodist Church is the United States' third largest faith group. While most evangelical denominations condemn same-sex relationships as sinful, Methodists stand almost alone among mainline denominations in not performing same-sex marriages, in contrast to the Episcopal Church, the Presbyterian Church USA, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the United Church of Christ, and more. Now, what did you hear in that paragraph?
Well, I heard that the United Methodist Church is the odd, in this case, sister out.
Right, but why use the figure 6 million members to define the United Methodist Church?
Okay, well, what I heard was, and I think some of this was actually going on in St. Louis too, an attempt to say, well, look, the real Methodists are here in the United States. And
exactly.
Besides, what we're proposing here won't affect any of you darker-skinned people on the other side of the planet.
Exactly. So what, if you're looking for end games here, I said in a column over a year ago, and I've said it many times at Get Religion, the only thing that mattered in St. Louis was not whether the traditional plan would win or not. What mattered was that the one church plan would lose, because every time this body meets, the one church plan will have fewer voters because the African churches and the global churches continue to grow while the liberal sections of the United Methodist Church here in America continued to decline. So this was the best chance ever for the one church plan to pass. In many ways, it doesn't matter at all that the traditional plan passed, because the church's kind of left-of-center establishment still controls the judiciary system, and the agencies and pretty much everybody else that gets to define what's happening here. So there are two questions. Does the left decide to fight on? Or is it time to go to the bargaining table and negotiate exit plans for both the left and the right? So the only things that mattered was, does the one church plan lose, and does the defeat of that plan push toward exits on both sides? Because otherwise, then you have to say something very, very cynical. The only hope for the left is to throw all the Africans out somehow. They have to cut off the global branch to give themselves a chance to win in the United States. And I think the One Church plan obviously would have passed as some sort of, gosh, can't we all in desperation stay together plan if it had only been Americans voting. But it lost relatively easily because the United Methodist Church is a global church. So why does the Washington Post story never mention the statistic for the actual membership of the United Methodist Church? It could just be a mistake. At the same time, it could be that what reporters who were on the scene in St. Louis heard over and over was 6 million, 6 million, 6 million, 6 million. And that number went in like an earworm and stuck. And this could be the direction the church establishment has decided to go. We have got to cut off the global churches and go it alone in the United States. Now, let's look at it from the viewpoint of the people on the traditional side. Now, supposedly, they won in St. Louis. That doesn't mean anything if the liberal establishment controls the courts and continues to tie this thing up and tie this thing up. And the chaos that they've lived with since the late 70s just continues to exist and drag everybody down. So they won, but what did they win? They won chaos. The chaos gets to continue. But stop and think about it for a second. If you were a traditionalist in Africa or in one of the larger sections of the American church that tends to be more theologically conservative, do you want to control the structure of the current United Methodist Church in the United States? It's bleeding money and membership in certain parts especially. Let me just give you a comparison. Christianity Today just put up a very interesting map from numbers that are 2 years old, but it still tells you a lot. And in addition to showing that West Africa has 2.1 million United Methodists, Congo has 2.9 million. Actually, it's 2.999. So let's just say 3 million there in the Congo. In addition to numbers like that, it shows the size of the five American jurisdictions. Now, if you know United Methodism, you know that most of the activism for LGBTQ issues is in the West, Colorado in particular, and churches along the bright blue West Coast, and in the Northeast, up in the Acela zone between Washington, D.C. and Boston, and to some degree the upper Midwest. So let me give you some interesting figures here. How many United Methodists are in the West? The conference that has started this fight has been the center of opposition to these policies, and the conference that has already said, we will refuse to obey the new laws no matter what you do. How many United Methodists are in the Western Conference? According to these numbers, 295,000. 295,000 in the entire Western Conference. And like I said, whatever this number is, it's lower now than it was 2 years ago. Now, where is the traditional church centered? Now, this doesn't mean that this entire region is traditional by any means, but it tends to be the more conservative area of the church. That would be the Southeast, to no one's surprise, right? How many United Methodists are in the Southeastern Conference? 2.6 million. So Bible Belt Southeast, 2.6 million. Western, 295,000. Now, then you look at the other huge regions for the liberals. You have the North Central, the Midwest, which are mostly liberal, but some conservatives still up there, 1.1 million. The Northeastern, the real power center, you know, in terms of seminaries and big guns, et cetera, 1.12 million. South Central, which would, I think, include Texas. I think Texas is in there. and a couple of other states kind of in the southwestern region. The south central region, 1.6 million. So even within the United States, the sections of the church that are rapidly shrinking tend to be the ones who are supporting the LGBTQ agenda. The sections of the church that are not necessarily growing, some of their churches are growing, some of they're not, but let's just say that they're at least plateaued, are in slow decline as opposed to rapid decline, are the Southeast and the South Central. And you add those two together, and you're looking at like 4.5 million out of that 6 million. So if you're a traditional Methodist leader right now, do you want the power structure of the U.S. Methodist Church?
Who would?
Or would you rather start over? You have 13 United Methodist seminaries, and I hesitate to use this figure because it's really hard to verify it, but I was looking at a set of figures earlier today for the number of graduates from all of those seminaries. You could make a case that those 13 United Methodist seminaries graduate fewer pastors or clergy every year than the one seminary, Asbury Seminary, which is not even legally a United Methodist seminary, but that's where most of the graduates of churches, or a high percentage of the graduates of churches in the Southeast and the Bible Belt, most of their people come from Asbury. Asbury receives no money from the national denomination. All those other seminaries get $1 million apiece. And this article I was reading said that one of the seminaries in the Western jurisdiction, the one I used to live a couple of blocks from in Denver, is receiving something to the tune of $125,000 of support for every graduating minister. Now, that doesn't include what the student's paying. That's just what the church is paying to keep the doors open at that seminary. So, you're a traditional United Methodist. Do you want those seminaries?
It'd be a disaster.
So, do you see what I'm saying here? The only story that mattered in St. Louis was twofold. One, does the One Church plan lose? Second, is there an exit plan that applies to churches on the right as well as to those on the left? Everybody in the mainstream press right now is writing stories about whether liberal churches are going to start leaving. That's a valid story. You can talk to them about it. But that isn't the issue right now. The issue is whether the door is finally open for millions and millions of traditional United Methodists to leave and set up what I think would be really interesting. I don't have a horse in this race as an Orthodox Christian. I'm not even a Protestant. But as someone who covers news and has covered this story since I moved to Denver in the mid-80s and was right in the center of the United Methodist warfare, which literally began in Denver in terms of national headlines, I think it would be really interesting if there was a global Wesleyan body. Doesn't that strike you as an interesting thing to have? I mean, you have the Catholic Church, which is global. You have national churches. You have the Eastern Orthodox Communion. And with some of us don't get along all that well from time, but you can still say there's a communion. But in the world of Protestantism, everything has been defined in terms of groups of people inside individual nations fighting with each other over LGBT issues, which actually stands for biblical and doctrinal issues. Wouldn't it be intriguing if there was a global Wesleyan church? That's really something interesting to stop and think about.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of a special session of the General Conference of the United Methodist Church. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate. When we come back, we'll talk about those attempts to at least work toward what the United Methodists were calling graceful exits.
My Chicago is.
The Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference is coming to Chicago for its one and only 2019 conference. You can meet and hear Ross Douthat, Matt Harrison, Wesley Smith, Aaron Wolf, Hans Feeney, and Will Whedon Friday, June 7th and Saturday, June 8th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Mark your calendars for the Scott Credit Union Metro East Home and Garden Show, March 16th and 17th, at and to benefit Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville. The Home and Garden Show is a fundraiser produced by a volunteer parents group with the support of regional businesses and partners. The Metro East Home and Garden Show has something for everyone, from the basement to the roof and everything in between, to lawn care and landscaping outside your home. From kettle corn and monster trucks to tractors and zero turns, family-friendly activities from child fingerprinting and face painting to child and fire safety. Take advantage of pet adoption, electronics recycling, and shredding services on site Saturday only. And Fredbird flies in on Sunday. Admission and parking are free, compliments of Element Turf. The Scott Credit Union Metro East Home and Garden Show, March 16th and 17th, is sponsored in part by Liberty Fence, Renown Remodeling, Seavers Equipment, and Woods Basement Systems. Show and exhibitor details can be found at mehds.org.
Welcome back. We're talking about media coverage of a special session of the General Conference of the United Methodist Church that was held in St. Louis and ended recently. Terry Mattingly is our guest. He's Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, let's see if we can make some sense of at least one headline that was popping up all over social media after the special session of the General Conference ended, and that was that, in effect, the United Methodist Church had voted to expel LGBT pastors and LGBTQ-affirming congregations. Did that have something to do with their action on what they were calling graceful exits?
Actually, no, that's under the traditional plan. The traditional plan was broken up into planks. Some sections of the plan have already been ruled unconstitutional by the judiciary branch of the church. But some sections of the plan had not been ruled unconstitutional. And thus, you have votes, and technically speaking, you have a bunch of stuff that should go into effect next January 1. And included in those planks were several pieces of law now approved by General Conference, stating that you have to keep your ordination vows. Now, that may not sound all that radical, but for 40 years, United Methodist pastors and even bishops have been able to say, well, my regional conference doesn't want to enforce those laws, so you, you can't make us. These laws would say the national church now has the power to say, if you violate our doctrine and book of discipline, which you have taken vows to defend, if you violate it by performing a same-sex marriage, for example, 1 year suspension without pay, you do it again, you're defrocked. That's under the plan. Basically, it's saying the national church now has the authority to defend itself, to defend its own doctrines. Now, if I was on the left, I would want to give an exit plan to the conservatives and say, get out of here, because then you would control that mechanism again, and you could change it back in the new, smaller, blue zip code friendly United Methodist Church or whatever they choose to call themselves. The bad news is that you now have infinitely fewer growing churches doing offerings and contributing to the national church. So I hope that answered your question. Those headlines were accurate and based on the sections of the traditional plan that were passed. But as I said, the Western Conference has already stated, I don't care what they do, we will refuse to obey the laws of the national church, no matter what.
The graceful exits, I spoke with Mark Tooley a couple days ago, and he said, well, these graceful exits are an attempt to find a way to reconcile how the property of churches is ordinarily dispersed if a congregation leaves United Methodist Church, or trying to find some sort of, my word is amnesty, to allow congregations to leave with some of or all of their property.
Well, there's two levels to this. First of all, the Presbyterians did something like this years ago when the Southern Church reunited with the Northern Church, and they opened up a window of opportunity for churches to leave and take their property. So we've seen this in a Presbyterian context. The Episcopal Church adamantly refused to do that. And that is why, I mean, they passed a totally different change in their governmental structure. I believe it's called the Dennis Canon, which basically said dioceses no longer own their own property, which is what it was when it was called the Episcopal or the individual bishop, the diocesan church. Now the national church owns everything. And so I'm sure you've noticed the headlines through the years as the Episcopalian spending. It's kind of like an Episcopal Lawyer Employment Act. I mean, there have been millions and millions and millions of dollars of lawsuits fighting over these pieces of property. The United Methodist plan that people are seeking would let people on the left or the right exit with their property. Now, where things get complicated is, well, do you need to pay anything to keep your property since technically it belonged to your local conference? I mean, should you pay 20% of the land value? Should you do this, that, or the other? The other thing is, if you actually end up carving the denomination apart, conservatives have donated millions and millions and millions of dollars to trust funds and institutions and buildings, campgrounds, colleges, etc. Should there be any attempt to divide the financial assets of those institutions? Now, it helps to know that United Methodist seminaries and colleges are technically independent. They run themselves, but they then receive money from the denomination. So I don't think these schools would get into these battles. But at some point, the trust funds, the monies, the bank accounts, if you have a true national split in the church, which ultimately I think is the painful but the more constructive solution, letting the left and the right, they have completely different theologies, let them go their separate ways. Toward the end of the St. Louis warfare, I tweeted out, I was reading all the wrap-up stories, and I tweeted out, still reading, based on facts seen today, what is the alternative to more United Methodist war? What is the alternative storyline? I was talking to journalists. What is the alternative storyline that actually helps local congregations on both the left and the right? In effect, I'm asking, what is the incentive to keep fighting at this moment? Why fight on? That's where I think there's a lot of hard reporting that needs to be done here. But I think you could make a case that the goal of the left has been to run out as many conservative churches as they could, while to kind of do the Anglican, the Episcopal thing again, get rid of the conservatives and still get to keep the money and get to keep as many of those churches as possible. People that just don't feel like they can give up their hard fought for land and church buildings. But if you have an honest, negotiated exit plan that lets both the left and the right walk away with their properties, that's the only thing that's going to stop the fighting. There was a rather poignant tweet from a man named Eric. I won't get his name into it. What, and he used the hashtag UMCCGC, what the United Methodist General Conference has shown us is that there is no middle way to bring the traditionalist and progressive position together in one denomination. The vote is now 55% to 45%, and it will widen with the growth of the African, Filipino, and Asian churches. It is not a question if, but who leaves. I retweeted that and added on top of it, reporters, here is the factual hook for follow-up news stories. What are the statistical trends, and how do they affect the next stage of the war? Why will the fighting continue? That's the interesting question, and the one that I'm not seeing anyone addressing from a financial perspective or a legal or theological perspective in the stories we're reading.
What did you make of the open letter that appeared from the general minister and president of the United Church of Christ to Methodists, essentially saying, look, we're open and affirming, and since the meanies over there, the mean Wesleyans don't like you, you can come and join us.
Well, it's a logical story, except that the United Church of Christ is completely congregational in orientation. If you wanted to think of this logically, the people who should be talking right now, because they at least have a Protestant version of an bishop-driven or episcopal structure, what would happen if the Episcopal Church, the ELCA Lutherans, and the liberal United Methodist united? That would be a declining, an aging, but that would be a bunch of people. And that would be some huge trust funds. You could consolidate, you could eliminate some of the dead wood in terms of seminaries or whatever. But that's a really interesting story. And they could logically, they could figure out how to unite since they're based on kind of things that look like dioceses and they have a bishop structure. That makes more sense than trying to merge with Presbyterians or, you know, the United Church of Christ, were completely congregational and regional in their structures. You really have to get desperate to do that. And that's what happened up in Canada, where, pardon the theological humor, they were predestined to have a merger between Wesleyans and Presbyterians and Calvinists, creating the United Church of Canada. I don't know how in the world you work out theology when you merge Methodists, Wesleyans with Calvinists. Didn't that strike you as a bit of a challenge? Yeah. Or did Luther already do that?
No, not at all. I'm curious also about whether or not the traditional plan passes, but it is widely acknowledged that the bishops and the governing structure in that sense of the United Methodist Church, apart from its book of discipline, its laws, are just trying to, you know, wait out the traditionalists. Do you think that the traditional plan will actually be implemented?
Well, I mean, that's a question. I you know, it's going to be a mess. The question is, there's a Wesleyan organization that's going to meet here in a couple of weeks to decide how to respond to what happened in St. Louis. Now, if the One Church plan had passed, you would expect this group of Wesleyan folks to exit from the right, whether they got to keep their properties or not. I don't see those guys voting to leave right now because technically they just won. And all of the statistical patterns are on their side. At this point, I can understand why the right would want to keep fighting. What I don't understand is why the left wants to keep fighting unless they know they need as many of the center and conservative churches to stay because they need the money. And they need those congregations and they need those people to be a viable church when you consider the growth and decline and aging patterns in the five USA jurisdictions that I read to you earlier. Yet there's the exit plan thing is really intriguing, but I'll stick by my position, which I stated over a year ago going into this. The only thing that mattered in St. Louis, in the long run, is whether exit plans are approved. because theologically you can't keep these people together. They disagree on very, very foundational issues related to moral theology, I would argue the Trinity, salvation, and a host of other things. They're already functioning as separate churches. Why keep spending millions of dollars to carry on the civil war?
So finally, how would you evaluate the media coverage in general, apart from the example you brought of the report that cut in half the total number of United Methodists in the world? How would you evaluate the media coverage?
Well, once again, the entire thing was viewed as if this was a battle between Trump supporters and enlightened woke Methodists who have already decided to be on the right side of history. The entire thing was covered through the lens of LGBT issues alone. Now, those are obviously crucial issues. That's where a lot of the fire is right now. That isn't the only thing that's going on. I saw a CBS report that literally the report was pictures of the Westboro Baptist Church people protesting outside, and they cut from that. That represented the conservatives. Now, the Westboro people are protesting the Wesleyans in general on theological principle because they're such strict Calvinists. But so visually, you had Westboro Baptist versus a articulate, calm gay minister speaking for the One Church plan. That was how CBS chose to represent this thing. It's kind of hard to imagine anything more stereotypical than Westboro Baptist versus the good guys, right? That's what CBS did, and at least in this one report that I saw. So, yeah, it was mainly covered as a massive defeat for thinking, caring, loving people everywhere involving the LGBT issue alone. Hardly anybody talked about the financial issues here. Hardly anybody talked about the fact that, frankly, Africans and Russians and others are not Republicans. You know, they're not Donald Trump people. You know, that this is yet another dramatic chapter in the rise of the next Christendom, as the historian Philip Jenkins has dubbed it, the next Christendom, which is in the global South. This is another part of that story, which has affected Presbyterians, Methodists, Anglicans, Catholics, and a bunch of others. In a bizarre way, you could say that the same drama was unfolding in Rome at the sexual abuse summit, where only one African was allowed to speak out of the entire conference in Rome on sexual abuse. And I wrote my column about her, and that'll come out here in a day or two.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's also founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, talk with you next week.
You bet. Talk to you then.
When we come back from this break, Joy Pullman, managing editor of The Federalist, will be with us. We're going to talk about the call for universal daycare. She says it's not only nationalized daycare, it's also socialized daycare. We'll find out why after this.
Church music directors can find a new community at Prelude to Postlude, the CPH music blog. Learn helpful tips for managing music ministry and involving members, and meet the composers of some of your favorite new pieces. Plus, find suggestions of music to use for special services, and preview some of our newest works with free samples you can use at your church. Visit us at preludetopostlude.org.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Often imitated, never equaled. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Mount Olive Lutheran Church in Duluth, Minnesota would like to invite you to join us Sunday mornings at 9:30. Whether you are visiting our beautiful city or live here, we have liturgical worship that shares Jesus with you. We're easy to find at 20th Avenue East and Superior Street, and also offer Bible classes at 8:25 Sunday mornings with Sunday school September through May. Check out our website for other Bible study times, visit or call 218-724-2500.
Many Lutheran pastors outside of the U.S. receive little or no seminary education. Luther Academy provides theological triage through conferences, books, and journals. Help support Luther Academy by making a tax-deductible donation at lutheracademy.com or call 260-452-2211. Serving Lutheran pastors to the ends of the earth, Luther Academy, 260-452-2211 or lutheracademy.com.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. St. Paul Lutheran, Cullman, Alabama. Christ the King Lutheran, Redlands, California. Good Shepherd Lutheran, Collinsville, Illinois. Redeemer Lutheran, Marshalltown, Iowa. Trinity Lutheran, Wichita, Kansas. Lord of Life Lutheran, Chesterfield, Missouri. Faith Lutheran, Rogue River, Oregon. Bethlehem Lutheran, North Zulch, Texas. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Lexington, Kentucky. Trinity Lutheran, Springfield, Illinois, Redford Lutheran, Detroit, Michigan, and Good Shepherd Lutheran, Arnold, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your church on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal.